Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and the health of our communities, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our society, and the ecological stability and balance of planet Earth. Each week on Connect the Dots, we discuss all the different facets of our interconnected world and how they affect us and what we can do to support and protect water, health, the environment, food, and life on Earth. I'm a long-standing journalist covering both personal well-being as well as all of the actions and ways that we can participate in being health protectors and creating a better society. My guest on today's show, I'm delighted to welcome back. I haven't actually counted, but I'm pretty sure he's probably been one of the most regular guests on Connect the Dots in the 8 years that the show has been running. And when you learn his special area of expertise, you'll certainly understand why. My guest today is William Wehrin. He's a senior trade analyst at Friends of the Earth, and he covers negotiations, litigation, and congressional action on trade policy. Now, you may recall, longtime listeners, that we've had a lot of coverage of international trade agreements over the last 4 years on Connect the Dots, covering the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the granting of executive authority under that, as well as other trade agreements. And Bill Wehrin has been one of our definitely go-to experts providing information that really isn't that well covered in the mainstream press. Bill has published numerous technical research papers as well as popular journalism on trade policy, and he's frequently quoted in mainstream outlets like The Washington Post, The Guardian, television news shows here and abroad. And Bill himself is an attorney and has, you know, a long-standing track record as an expert on these issues. So today, with new activity going on in NAFTA, NAFTA 2.0, as we call it, Bill Wehrin is back to update me and all of you listeners as to what the issues are in the upcoming realignment of the NAFTA trade deal. Welcome back to Connect the Dots, Bill.
Well, thank you very much, Allison. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your radio show.
So, you know, just to kind of resume for our listeners, you know, in the 2016 campaign, we had ostensibly both presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and our current president, Donald Trump, nominally, at the very least, opposing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, trade agreement. This was, some considered, a turnkey in the election of Trump, because he was really speaking to the populations in the United States who had been the most hard hit by the outsourcing of industry around the world. And Senator Clinton, although ostensibly opposed, was kind of well known by all to have helped champion and promote the deals as Secretary of State. So, you know, and I, in fact, wrote several articles about this. So at the time when President Obama was not able to follow through with his hope of passing what he regarded as his legacy, he said this many times, namely the TPP, when that really he didn't have the votes in Congress to pass this at the end of 2016 in the lame duck Congress before the new administration and new legislators came in 2017. That was a disappointment to him and a victory for our side, and we were happily celebrating it while also knowing that the current president's word on almost any topic, you know, would be very subject to change and influence. And in fact, that has proven to be the case, although he still confusingly retained some vestige of his former opposition while at the same time moving ahead in the form of a revision of NAFTA. Can you update us as to, you know, where the current administration now stands and, you know, what are the most controversial or concerning features of the coming revision of the trade deal?
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. As a friend of mine said about Donald Trump, you can't believe a word he says. That was actually her full press release one day. And so we constantly are getting contradictory and oftentimes irrational statements from the White House on the renegotiation of NAFTA. But if you look at his actions and the statements and writing of some of the more competent people who work for him, in particular Bob Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, it's clear that in the process of renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement, that you know, they may make some changes around the edges that would satisfy their xenophobic and nationalist impulses. But when it comes to the public interest, and in particular the environment, there is every reason to expect that Trump's NAFTA 2.0 will be even worse for the planet than the current NAFTA or even the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because we've seen what Trump has done in office, where he's practically destroyed the Environmental Protection Agency. He's rolling back all kinds of environmental safeguards. And this same war on the planet is proceeding in NAFTA negotiations. There are a whole series of technical provisions we can talk about later in which he is seeking to undermine environmental protections at every level of government.
Yes, that is certainly true, and I would say that is, I mean, it's a key feature of his entire administration. And, you know, he's kind of doing a very good job in terms of his appointments internally and what they're doing within the respective, you know, departments that they lead, the Environmental Protection Agency and others. You know, they're doing a very good job of kind of disassembling everything. You know, one of the concerns about the trade deals prior was that they would, you know, kind of put the U.S. in a position of compliance where we would be forced to deregulate. Again, that's always against public health protection and, you know, for industry profits. But, I mean, do we actually, I mean, are the trade deals, will they be able to, you know, will NAFTA be able to do more than, you know, what he's even, you know, what they're doing now internally?
Oh, absolutely. It will not only reinforce Trump's war on the environment, but because it's an international law measure, it'll lock in place once, even when Trump is gone, this deregulatory agenda, this attack on basic and necessary environmental safeguards.
And how would that, how will that happen?
Well, to get just a little bit into the weeds, there are a whole series of chapters or subdivisions of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And one new one they're working on is called Regulatory Review, which might mean, which really means wholesale deregulation. It sets up institutions and procedures for rolling back and environmental and other public interest safeguards, and from creating institutions and procedures that will stand in the way of the promulgation of new safeguards. And then there are a whole series of chapters within the North American Free Trade Agreement that deal with various kinds of public health and environmental issues. To use a technical term, there's a chapter called Technical Barriers to Trade. And this is trade law gobbledygook, meaning that this is international trade law language that will make it very, very difficult to protect the public from hazardous chemicals. And in the same way, it will stand in the way of new regulations related to pesticides, you know, the pesticides that are killing the bees and threatening, you know, the crops that and the fauna that or the flora that are pollinated by bees, and as well as some other steps, and then there are a whole series of these chapters of this character that we can talk about or not, which really zero in and roll back important safeguards.
That's terrible. Yes, I think we should talk about those chapters. Is this along the lines of what was in the earlier trade agreements, or is it actually taking it a step further?
Oh, it's taking it a step further. It's much, much worse than even the horrible Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. Now, we do not yet have the legal text, but we know what Trump's agenda is. We have every reasonable expectation that there is going to be all kinds of language in here that will protect a future more progressive government in the United States from protecting the public health and the environment.
In other words, you're saying that if he was succeeded by a more progressive presidency and administration, these provisions as a global trade deal or as a continental trade deal would be locked in place, mm-hmm. and therefore they would supersede what a future administration would be able to actually do?
Well, that's right. Now, in theory, a future administration could defy the NAFTA 2.0 trade rules, but if they did so, there would be retaliatory sanctions that could be applied by another country, or in some cases by an individual investor. You know, this could be, you know, higher tariffs on U.S. goods. It could be loss of intellectual property rights for U.S. firms. So while in theory, a new progressive administration in the White House in the future could proceed with a progressive and an environmentally sensible agenda, if these trade deals are in place, then litigation can proceed internationally with pretty sharp sanctions against the United States, and that will have, at the very least, a significant chilling effect. At worst, it'll flat out stop new measures.
So, in other words, they are basically legislating forward in ways that would place a strong deterrent on undoing anything he did, so that, you know, if he does this regulatory takedown, as has been occurring internally at the Environmental Protection Agency, where, you know, the phrase climate change is removed, climate scientists have been let go, people are precluded from doing that kind of science, reporting on that kind of science, past science that's been done has been removed from public availability, all of that kind of thing, regulations, language has been changed in regulatory policy that, you know, is protective to health, food, and the environment. That's happening in this administration. But if a future administration, I'm just trying to really spell this out, comes back in and tries to turn these policies around, in effect, the signing of NAFTA 2.0 would provide a lock-in with strong deterrence that would make it exceedingly difficult, so that his particular moment in time of you know, of making these bad regulatory policies would kind of be locked in for, you know, forever, or how long forever will be under the circumstances, but, you know, would be locked in going forward. I mean, has there been any situation where anyone has extended that kind of control and power over a future time? Because it would seem to really unravel the foundations for democratic policy or public will in this area.
Well, that's the problem with international trade agreements, whether you talk about the World Trade Organization agreement or other existing agreements, the old NAFTA. They do create an enforceable international law. Ordinarily, when you have international law, if you think of international environmental law or international human rights law, you know, they're not institutions that can levy punitive sanctions for a violation. It's supposed to be sort of voluntarily enforced, and it sometimes voluntarily abided by only in the breach. But international trade and economic law really is really does have teeth. Former Director General of the World Trade Organization, Renato Ruggiero, once said of the World Trade Organization agreement that we have created a constitution for the world economy. So what you would see with the new NAFTA is a very reactionary constitution for the North American economy, one that can be effectively enforced.
Wow. This sounds really, really bad. Could you give a few examples of areas where, you know, this would kind of hold sway, you know, in areas that affect health and environment?
Well, I talked about the technical barriers to trade chapter, which affects regulation and the safeguards relating to chemicals, pesticides, and also product labels, like safety labels or content labels. But there's another chapter called sanitary and phytosanitary measures. And this is the area of food safety, which I know is something that you care about a great deal. And again, it would lock in effective prohibitions of progressive food safety measures. And also it would, another provision that affects animal welfare, which is, I know, is another thing that you were concerned about, and governmental measures intended to, for example, regulate those horrible factory farms, the ones that pack thousands of hogs or cattle into a small area and treat them inhumanely. Any attempt to regulate in that area could come under NAFTA international litigation. It's really an enforceable laissez-faire project, and it's really quite frightening. And there are a number of other chapters in the NAFTA and in similar trade agreements that specifically inhibit government action in the public interest, and especially in the interest of the planet.
Well, you know, speaking of animal welfare, the administration recently struck down in the organic standards for organic food a kind of cluster of new policies that would provide, you know, clarity around organic guidelines for the raising, you know, and treatment of livestock in order to be treated humanely, and you know, and to participate in the organic label, to be considered organic food, so that people who were consuming meat but did not wish to participate or have anything to do with this horrible factory farming system could rest secure that, you know, the livestock animals produced under the organic label did not conform to these horrible practices. But the Trump administration, I think after 4 or 5 years of negotiation about what these new standards would be, which, you know, in fact, a lot of, or clarifying standards would be, which in fact many felt were, you know, just beginning to make a dent, you know, they just summarily decided not to go with them recently. And so this is, you know, in keeping with, you know, that entire thing. I mean, the other thing that strikes me is, like, on the one hand, you have the degrading of what was a meaningful label, successful industry that, you know, that many consumers sought to, you know, and still do seek to purchase on. So, you know, so then you have the degrading of an existing label, but then, as you mentioned, you know, not providing for labels or prohibiting labels that would be, you know, revealing to consumers, you know, what was coming to them from various kinds of products purchased abroad, is the removal of, you know, a very important protection, because otherwise, you know, you could, I mean, anyone could be purchasing a food that's contaminated, that has heavy metals, that was produced under some toxic conditions, that was inhumane to animals. I mean, there's just a very long list of things. You know, there could be hygienic concerns, you know, presence of bacteria and different things. And, you know, so, for example, you know, in this country recently there was, you know, E. coli was found in some romaine lettuce. But if something happened in a foreign country, you know, that was exporting to the U.S. something apparently as benign as a fruit or vegetable, but for some reason, you know, whether it was genetic modification or some way of treating or rinsing, you know, foods in countries with much lower standards than ours, you know, this could make it into the country, could be dangerous, and nobody would have a way of identifying where it came from so they could avoid it.
Yes, this is a very, very serious concern. Again, it's part of really a coordinated plan by multinational companies to use these trade agreements and every other means at their disposal to deregulate and give them free rein. And it happens in a whole variety of areas. One of the things I worry about most is that there's an intellectual property chapter and some other provisions in NAFTA, and the biotechnology industry has an agenda here. They want to move forward without the hindrance of regulations or precautionary safeguards with all kinds of biotech products and even synthetic biology, you know, in which, you know, they're not just replacing genes from one species to one species from another, but they're literally writing new genetic code and creating new living things. And if ever there was a case where we need to apply the precautionary principle so that we know exactly what the consequences will be in terms of life forms in the environment, this is one. But I really worry about the intellectual property chapter and the other provisions in NAFTA that would allow all this synthetic biology and biotech experimentation to go forward without any oversight or risk control.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Let's dive in there for a little bit because, I mean, that is tremendously concerning. You know, in the drive you know, many years to label GMO products because, you know, basically they were inadequately studied when they were first introduced by the companies producing them. And then, you know, the FDA and USDA, they just kind of went along with that. And, you know, since then, you know, concerns have surfaced. And, you know, there was a whole campaign to label so that people could just make a choice. I want to participate in this, and it's like, okay with me versus no, thank you, I don't. And that's even, that's just at the level of personal consumer choice, not even saying, you know, what does it do to the earth to have this kind of food produced under agricultural conditions, you know, that are contaminative, that are undermining climate, you know, in an effort to just squeeze out as many crops as possible from a piece of land, leaving that land in a devastated and climate vulnerable position, you know. So there are systemic effects to our personal choices, obviously. But in terms of the science of GMOs, more focus has landed on, or more scientific proof has come along from the World Health Organization about glyphosate, the principal pesticide that is the one designed for use with these genetically modified crops because they are supposedly resistant to the effects. And so this was the whole rationale for genetically modifying these various crops. And, of course, it didn't account for the fact that the pesticide use increased astronomically year after year as the bugs developed resistance to the pesticide to the point where, you know, there's now a major contamination impact along with the climate impact that I just described. So, you know, but on the other side, a lot of the original scientific question or tug of war about this was, you know, what about modifying genes? Like, what does that do? What, you know, are there health risks that are entailed by that? You know, those questions have still not been answered, you know, and yet, you know, so it now seems like, you know, in that gap, you know, of failing to do the science and not really being able to understand the implications of that, now there is going to be a lot more of that kind of genetic experimentation, as it were. Are you perhaps acquainted through your international work with other scientific hypotheses or concerns about the population, you know, being increasingly exposed to unknown risks as we continue to sort of also study genes and find out more about genes? We, you know, we don't know a whole lot about our own genes. You know, we're just beginning to learn, you know, what are the, have you heard any other, you know, kind of anything else in scientific or legal circles about, you know, the potential risk we're undertaking in, you know, if this were to proceed?
Well, I know that the European Union has great concern. Now, the European Union charter is, you know, very pro-corporate, but it's, you know, it's they don't have the same kind of anti-science, anti-government ideology to the same extreme that you see it in the Trump administration. Well, they have a generally free market, laissez-faire approach. When it comes to questions of food safety and chemical safety and so forth, the European Union does a reasonably good job. And, of course, the United States is litigated under trade deals to try to undercut those EU sanctions. But the European Union's paying attention, at least to a certain degree, to these risks and acting to protect the planet and the public interest in a way we haven't seen in the United States.
And what are their concerns from a scientific perspective?
Well, I think it's the same concerns that any cautious person would have. That I guess it's sort of what I would call the precautionary principle light. I mean, one of the central ideas of the environmental movement is do no harm. That do not change the environment until you know what the consequences are likely to be as a result of some technological innovation or industrial action or whatever. That there is a certain burden of proof in terms of safety that must be met before one proceeds with a potentially out of control technology. And the European Union pays some attention to the precautionary principle, and it's largely disregarded in the United States by the powers that be.
Yeah, so we're kind of accelerating and moving forward with some, you know, with the whole policy of taking risk that, you know, at any point along the way may be proving reckless. And yet, because also our medical system doesn't really have a lot of sophistication in terms of our understanding the interaction between multiple toxic exposures and, you know, various illnesses. We just see the illnesses. We treat the illnesses. There's a big disconnect there. We don't know what may have caused this tremendous rise in, you know, all the major killer diseases, you know, cancer, neurological illnesses, all kinds of things. We just, you know, there's a dissociation and a lack of science and, an incapacity to study and an incapacity to be, precautionary in weight. And now that will be, those risks will be accelerating and under NAFTA. Will the provisions of NAFTA be carried forward, you know, apart from, you know, our continent and our place? Will this become a template for other trade agreements that are, you know, involving other sectors of the globe, or?
Yeah, the intent of the Trump administration is to renegotiate a whole series of existing trade and investment agreements in order to pursue their nationalistic and deregulatory agenda on the international stage.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been some talk about, and this has also been some talk about new trade deals. I think there's an expectation that as soon as the United Kingdom leaves the, legally leaves the European Community, that there would be an attempt to create a UK-US trade deal that would be, you know, wildly laissez-faire, pro-business, implicitly pro-corporate agenda. And of course this would even though the Tory party in England finds Donald Trump to be louche and offensive and ignorant, they still pursue a similar agenda, which is to roll back government safeguards, to expand the power of corporations, and allow the market to go free of any kind of hindrance.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely bad news on multiple fronts there. What should be our concerns about the environmental impact of NAFTA, of the new NAFTA?
Well, most broadly, it is clearly going to jumpstart and accelerate fossil fuel production and burning. I mean, the whole idea is to drill, 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 and burn, burn, burn. It's intended to encourage coal mining, fossil fuels of every kind, and we could see a marked uptick in global warming, mm-hmm. not only in North America but around the globe, because Canada, the United States, and Mexico are all fossil fuel exporters. So in this way, you can see how an agreement that's legally binding only within North America could have important environmental and public policy consequences around the world as North American fossil fuels flood the market everywhere.
You know, because your work is done for Friends of the Earth, and I know you work closely with the people there who work on climate. And in fact, we've had previous shows where we've kind of had both you and, you know, your climate expert here on Connect the Dots discussing, you know, the kind of collective implications of some of these agreements and other social decisions. Has the team at Friends of the Earth kind of done any projections in terms of tracking where we're currently headed, which isn't obviously that, you know, which isn't very good, you know, given the fact that even in the last year we've seen, you know, changes that are noticeable within the U.S. itself as well as globally. You know, so it what, you know, used to be, it's, you know, the kind of projection of, oh, well, 250 years from now, you know, there may be some impacts, has now become, you know, through the failure to act in the proper way and instead continuing and upticking this, you know, these activities, which we know to be destructive, you know, and all of the confusion around that of denial, you know, really perpetrated by people who have a vested financial interest in continuing these activities regardless of their impact on planetary life. So we, you know, have at the outset of these considerations, maybe in the last 10 years ago or something, it would be like, well, 500 years from now, 200 years from now, but our failure to act in time and instead to accelerate these harmful activities has brought, you know, the window for disruption felt by ever-increasing numbers of people closer and closer. You know, as far as I'm aware, do you have any projections of where this is going based on where we are now, as, you know, in terms of how soon radical disruptions will be felt by the, you know, kind of living in blissful ignorance for the moment population versus, you know, what will come into force once, you know, these deals are, you know, this deal is enacted?
Well, I'm not a climate scientist, but there's a lot of peer-reviewed climate science out there that clearly shows that the risk is increasing and the planet is heating up rapidly. And whereas we should be taking emergency precautionary measures, now we're just going in the opposite direction under Donald Trump and putting the future of the planet and our civilization very much at risk. So, I can't speak with any authority on the science. It's not my field, but, you know, there's a lot of peer-reviewed, highly reputable scientific work, which, you know, over 95% of the scientists in the field agree with, that establishes the fact that the planet and our civilization is going to be put in peril over coming decades.
Right. Yeah, we're now talking about decades, you know, where we were talking about, like, you know, a century or more. I mean, I, you know, have two nieces who are millennials. I'm very fond of them. And, you know, they don't personally, I mean, now they're in their 20s, and they're not anticipating living into their 50s, you know, for example. And and they tell me that, you know, many of their peers, you know, feel the same way and share that concern. It's, you know, these scenarios are really hard for people to envision. And, you know, then we, you know, become overwrought and distracted by, you know, kind of immediate dramas, while, you know, this kind of, and I'm not putting, you know, for example, nuclear threats as, I mean, I wouldn't call that a drama, for example. That's a real, you know, immediate short-term concern. But, you know, but barring that, there's a lot of other things that one can and should and would, according to one's values and ethics, be concerned about. And, you know, and people do feel rightly concerned about it, but how, you know, how do we, but, you know, but that's why this huge problem, you know, is kind of heading our way, or we're rushing toward it. And, you know, these other things, as important as they may seem, actually can distract us from the big event that's going on. And from, you know, what we're talking about today, the redrafting of NAFTA is part of that big event. How aware do you think people are about this, and what, if anything, could people do, you know, to prevent or stall it at this point?
Well, I think it's very important for all your listeners and others who read your published material to get engaged politically and communicate forcefully and thoughtfully to members of your congressional delegation and to organize, you know, not to, you know, to, you know, in solidarity their strength, you know, not only individual communications to policymakers and the press, but organized community activities to highlight these threats and to publicize them. And you know, I think you've seen a lot of activity since Trump came in. You know, we see people who used to be apolitical running for office.
Mm-hmm.
We see people who used to pay very little attention to public affairs, you know, marching in the streets and raising a little age. So I think that's how it happens. It happens in each of our neighborhoods, each of our towns, each of our communities.
And who do you regard, or who currently in the national political spectrum, who would, you know, be by right those having a say on the signing of this or blocking its passage in some way? Is it possible legislatively, you know, within Congress and the Senate to block it? Who are the champions, you know, critics of it, that people, you know, that we could also point people toward as examples?
Well, I think I would highlight the U.S. House of Representatives Progressive Caucus,
mm-hmm.
people like Keith Ellison from
mm-hmm.
From Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
and I think that there are a few senators, obviously Bernie Sanders, who are also on the cutting edge and are influential not only on Capitol Hill, but as well-respected public voices people who are creating a movement across the country, as well as people who are influencing the course of legislation on the Hill. So there are a number of very good people
doing that. Would you what is the time frame in which one could foresee the potential passage and signing of this? Is it something that votes in midterm elections would have a role to play, for example, if there was a turnover in Congress? Would that be happening in time to kind of stop this in its tracks, or is it going to be a kind of done deal? Is it likely to be a done deal well before that could ever happen?
Well, they haven't cut the deal yet, but the Trump administration is making every effort to try to get at least an agreement in principle concluded in the next couple, 3 weeks, so that then they can work on the legal text. And there's legislation in terms of the, a notice period before legislation is introduced in Congress. But they're under a very tight schedule, and their goal is to get Trump's NAFTA rewrite approved in the lame duck session of Congress after the election, because members of Congress do not want to take a vote on this before the election, because these agreements and these provisions in particular are extremely unpopular with the public. But then they have a session of Congress in November and December, where you have a lot of members who were, going to be retiring in January from the Congress, and maybe making a few million dollars on Wall Street or as Washington lobbyists, and that's when they like to get these trade deals approved. And when there is it really cuts the public out of it, and it's the same hazard we faced in the past, that they'll try to approve this at the lame duck session.
And there are, in fact, many people quitting politics because, they came in to do what they did, then they're getting, their payout when they leave, in terms of moving on. I mean, as much as I feel it's important to get corporate money out of politics and have publicly financed campaigns and all the rest of it, and to only vote really for candidates and elected officials who are not, are running without taking corporate money, because basically once they take the money, they, that's who they're representing. But, unfortunately, at this point in time, we have a big crop of those in office who all will be leaving, and this will be their final, kiss-off as they go on to, kind of collect their pay after having done their bidding, the bidding of the companies who will profit from this destruction. Given that, I can foresee, a huge maelstrom in the fall, as we, in the summer and fall, as we had before. Now, I have another question, which is, what is the disposition of the Canadian government, of Trudeau and of that government toward this? Are they, kind of happily going along and accepting it, or are they any kind of obstacle to it? How is that? Because there we have an ostensibly, more of a liberal leader up north, and, is he fighting the good fight, or what is his stance?
Well, the Liberal Party in Canada is socially liberal. Mm-hmm. They're all for gay rights and free speech, and Premier Trudeau likes to wear multicolored socks and otherwise behave in sort of a cheerful bohemian way.
Uh-huh.
But this disguises the fact that they are a liberal party in the 19th century sense. They're very free market oriented. It's not a labor party.
Mm-hmm.
In Canada, that's the New Democrats. The New Democrats are the left Party. The Liberal Party, in current parlance, would be more like the Libertarian Party. And so they're very free market oriented. Now they do pursue some good environmental policies. They tend to favor national parks and things like that. But really, Canada is a great big gas station. Their whole economy, a booming economy, depends on massive exports of fossil fuels. And what you get with Trudeau and the Liberal government in Canada is lip service to the Paris Agreement, lip service to the threat of global warming, even as they continue to ramp up fossil fuel exploration, refinement, and exports. So it's a kind of insincerity when it comes to climate issues.
Well, I mean, that parallels the Democratic Party here, in fact, because, you know, we don't have that many leaders in the Democratic Party who are really true climate champions. And sadly, today, I'll mention parenthetically, or this week, we have the fall of one who was, which is Attorney General Eric Schneiderman of New York State, in a, you know, kind of a really kind of tragic, you know, revelations of alleged misbehavior and you know, serious misbehavior in a private relationship and all. So, you know, but he's in this state, you know, he's helped stop pipelines. He's been suing ExxonMobil. He's really been a force of speaking truth to power, and then, you know, had, you know, these kind of private, darker personal impulses, you know, which are, if true, you know, not that, they're rather terrible and harmful. But, you know, it's like this, I mean, brings up for me the question of priorities. You know, we kind of want to be correct on all sides of the different things that we regard as ethical and care about, but it is a really tragic thing to lose one of the rare Democratic Party climate champions. I mean, it's happening as we speak. And, you know, kind of puts us all in a quandary. I don't want to put you on the spot to suddenly have to comment on that, you know, but if you did have anything to say, you know, you could share that now. I mean, my own sense is, you know, I don't want to be throwing anyone, including women, you know, vulnerable women under a bus or anything, but, you know, we have these huge problem that will determine the destiny of every living being on Earth. And then we have, you know, the bad behavior within the current climate, you know, of a rare individual who, you know, was actually using his position of power to make good steps on the climate front. So we're kind of mourning that loss for many reasons today as we have this conversation.
Well, that's I think that's right, but it really calls for all of us to step forward, you know, and not depend on other people to always be the leader, but to be more than just a follower, but take personal responsibility for getting things done in one's own community and within one's own sphere. And, you know, we can't just hope that there'll be some savior on a white horse who's going to take care of us. We have to take personal responsibility.
Yes, I totally agree with that. That is, you know, that's really key. And, of course, you know, you know, on a certain level, one could say, you know, the hope that, you know, an individual in office is better than they seem, you know, relying on that, relying on people in power, you know, kind of playing up to them because of their power, you know, and then getting burned. You know, today we have people getting burned for that. And, I mean, as it happens, I actually spoke to former Attorney General Schneiderman about this problem, the only time I ever encountered him at a public event. And I saw his demeanor. I saw the person accompanying him. And I said to him, you know, you have to keep your nose clean about this because, you know, you could be a target. And you're, you know, because of the work you're doing in the environmental front, and you have to really, you know, kind of maintain appropriate behavior so as not to become, you know, at risk. And, you know, and because he was a public official, I mean, when I'm telling this to people now, people are like, what, you actually said that to him? I said, well, you know, he's my elected official. I kind of have a right to say that to him if I perceive the situation, which I did. You know, and if I'm wrong, then he probably will forget who I am anyway. But as I'm sure he did.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I did not feel equally free to say to the young woman, you know, you're shining in the spotlight right at this moment, but think about this. You know, like, what is this, you know, what is this about? How much, you know, of your own trust and belief. But in effect, the people placing the trust and belief in the shining figure and then finding out the dark side or, you know, trying to ignore what they're actually doing is all of us. You know, it's not just vulnerable young women or whatever. So I think your deduction from the whole thing is really appropriate and accurate. We're coming near to the end of our show. Today's Connect the Dots. And, you know, once again, great thanks to William Warren from Friends of the Earth for once again guiding us through the new developments and the, you know, the new risk factors and the new opportunities as a revisioning of the North Atlantic Federal Trade Agreement, NAFTA, is taking place. Thank you, Bill. I'm sure we'll be talking again as things progress and come to clarity. But thank you for this orientation and the invitation to activism. People can subscribe at Friends of the Earth to receive updates. And you know, Popular Resistance is another site that covers this. New York Trade Metro is another. There are a lot of places to follow these activities, as well as here on this program, Connect the Dots, and my Facebook page, Allison Rose Levy. So, you know, thanks again, Bill, and, you know, we'll be staying in touch as things develop.
Thank you so much, Allison. I really enjoy talking with you, and I think that your radio program is really one of the best around. It's a great public service.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you, listeners, for being with us today for another edition of Connect the Dots. With all of the things going on in our world, keep your eyes on this one. It's a very important predictor and lever in the kind of future that we will all experience, as well as future generations will. Thank you for being with us on today's show. We'll be back again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well, head tall, keep marching forward.
Well, well, well.